Mangali Vastranas Chakshushrotramato Palindriyani Chasarvani Sarvam Brahma Upanishadam Maham Brahma Nirakuryam Mama Brahma Nirakarot Anirakarnam Astva Nirakarnam Me Astu Tratmani nirateya upanishat sudharmaste mai santu te mai santu om shanti shanti shanti.
I'm going to go into part three. Whole of part three, which is how long? It's about 12 verses or so. And then another 3 verses in part four. So that's like 15 verses. And these 15 verses are a story. Okay. So I think what I feel like doing right now, instead of being so bogged down with the Sanskrit, which we will do. We will do the Sanskrit. But I'd like to just tell the story, okay, so that we can understand what the story is. Of course, the story is in keeping with the chapters that have gone before, but it's just telling it in story form. So it's nice. This is the story, as the story goes, you know. The devas and the asuras. The devas are the gods, the asuras are the demons. And in the creation, and every aspect of the creation, internally and externally, there's always this kind of war between the devas and the asuras, between the sattvic, buddhi, you know, the dharmanishtas, the ones who are an expression of Brahman, in harmony with Brahman, and the asuras who are trying to go their own way to fulfill their desires, basically. And so the asuras themselves, they're not interested in the common good. At all. They're interested in their own good, not in the common good. And so their behavior, their decisions are not for the sake of others. And so they're not good. They're not good for the society at all. Okay? Because in terms of their buddhi, you don't count. Only they and their immediate family, basically they and their immediate family and their own personal desires are what is important at any expense other than theirs. That's a good definition of an asura. Swamiji talks a lot about this in his commentary. So here, there was a war between the devas and asuras, and the asuras, for the sake of the world, for the sake of the peace and the shanti of the world, for the sake of the protection of all beings. There was a huge war. But as the story starts out, it says that Okay. That's fine. So as the story goes, in this war between the Devas and the Asuras, Brahman means Ishwara, because now there's the manifestation of the creation, so Brahman. Brahman brought about a victory for the Devas, because Brahman is the Sat-Chit of the whole creation, and Brahman is Ishwara, is all of the Shakti in the creation, and the one who gives the Karmapala. And so Brahman, really in the form of Ishwara, he brought about a victory for all of the Devas. And so then, in the victory, in Brahman's victory, in Ishwara's victory, all of the Devas, Devaha Amiyante, all of the Devas received tremendous, as Swamiji will say, they received tremendous worship and were highly honored. Also, in Ishwara's victory, between the Devas and the Asuras, the Devas rejoiced and received all honor for that. Thinking that this is our victory. This is our victory, and thinking, and we are great. Mahima, you know. We, as for us, this victory, this is our victory, and we are great. And they were having a party, really, as Swamiji would tell. They were having a great party, rejoicing in their prowess and their ability to conquer the Asuras and to bring about the peace in the world. So they say, we are so great. And then Brahman, kind of understanding them and who they are and what they're thinking, he took a form. He manifested himself as a yaksha. A yaksha is a celestial being, and the yakshas they're considered divine beings that are so impelling and so attractive that they just draw you toward them. And so he took the form of this very beautiful yaksha. So this was the first problem. So these Devas were so proud of themselves and had exploding egos, because they had exploding egos in their great prowess and their ability to conquer the Asuras. They see this yaksha. And so in seeing the yaksha, that's their first little bit of humiliation, in a sense, because they have no idea who that yaksha is. What type of a celestial being? They're thinking, who is that? What type of a celestial being is that? They can't place it anywhere. And they know, especially Indra was one of the three that are the most involved, Indra, Agni, and Vayu. You know, they should know all of the yakshas and all of the different classifications of the Devas. They know Indra is the king of all the Devas, so he should definitely be able to recognize this yaksha that is presenting in the distance there before them. But none of them know. And so the Devas, first they look at Agni. Agni is really the lord of speech and the one whom all offerings are made to. So Agni himself has quite a bit of prowess and quite a bit of respect. So they decide, we'll ask Agni. So they say to Agni, Agni, why don't you go? You go and approach that yaksha and find out what it is. Go and approach the yaksha, find out what it is. And so Agni says, yes, let it be so. Right. So he does. He approaches, he gets close within the vicinity of the yaksha. And as he approaches the yaksha, the yaksha says to him, who are you? Who are you? And that's the second little insult. Because I'm Agni, of course. I am the great Agni. I'm also known as Jataveda, the one who gives all wealth. You know, haven't you heard of me? I'm Agni. I'm Jataveda. I'm the one that gives all wealth. And then the yaksha responds, and she says, or he says, or it says, the yaksha isn't identified gender well. So then the yaksha says, Agni goes on to say, she asks him, what in having so much strength, what is it exactly that you can do? You know, because it's such an so important, what is it that you can do? And he says, I can burn everything on the earth. Anything that is there to be burnt, I can burn it. I can burn the entire earth. You know, that's my strength. And so she says, wow, when you have such viryam as this, when you have such strength, burn this for me. And the yaksha puts out just a little blade of grass. Let me see you burn this. Puts this little blade of grass right in front of you. And so it says, Agni, with all of his strength, he rushes toward this blade of grass with all of his strength, you know, throwing flames and flames, and finally a Swamiji sits on top of it to bake it or something. He's doing everything he possibly can to burn this little piece of grass. And it's even a little dry piece of grass. So he should be able to, like that. He cannot touch it. And so he doesn't say anything else. He just goes back to the group of devas. He retreats immediately. He just retreats. He goes back to his other group of devas, waiting to find out who this yaksha is. And he says, I don't know who it was. I don't know who that yaksha is. He doesn't say anything else. He doesn't say, something happened that was very embarrassing. He doesn't say that. He just, I don't know who the yaksha is. So then the devas, they say, to Vayu, the strength, he's the devata of strength. And so they say to Vayu, why don't you go? Well, Vayu, you go and find out who the yaksha is. And he says, yeah, tapa iti, let it be so, I will go. And so he takes off and he goes and he comes again into the vicinity of this yaksha who is just abiding there. And as he approaches, the yaksha says, who are you? And he says, you know, I am Vayu. I am the Matareshwa. I'm the one who can travel through the air without any, like the wind. I can move through space without any obstruction at all. You know? Vayu. I'm well known. I am the well known Vayu. You know? And so she says, what is it that you can do as Vayu? I can lift lift anything up and carry it away with me. It makes no difference. Anything. I can lift anything up and carry it away with me. And she says, well, somebody such as you, with this much viryam, this much strength, here. And she puts the same little piece of grass in front of him and says, let me see you lift up this grass and piece of, you know, grass, this little blade of grass, and carry it away. And she's thinking, is this even worth my time? But anyway, and Swamiji will say, the yaksha is so beautiful, so compelling. You know, and it like mesmerizing. And so, of course, he, overwhelmed, just was, yes, of course, even though I have all strength and I can blow the whole, everything in the universe up and carry it away, I will do that for you, this little blade of grass. So he rushes toward it, you know, with all of his strength and expecting it to just lift up and fly away up into the heavens. But he blows and blows and nothing happens. It doesn't move at all. Nothing happens. And so he, kind of shocked and embarrassed, kind of retreats and then goes back to the devas, to the group of devas, and he says, I don't know who that yaksha is. That's all he says. But then Swamiji will say, he and Agni, you know, kind of look at each other. they're just both thinking the same thing has happened to both of them, you know. And so then, these two, the other devas, there's probably some others there. It's not clear, but we assume that there's other devas there. And so then they looked at Indra, who is the lord of the devas. Right? And so looking to Indra, they say to Indra, Meghavan, the one who is worthy of worship. They look to him, and they say, you know, may you please go. Because he's the king of all of them. You please go. You go and find out. You He says, Tata, yes, let it be so. I will go. And so now he goes, and he goes toward this yaksha, and as he approaches, the yaksha disappears. And so now he's just standing there. The yaksha is gone. And so he doesn't even get to see the yaksha. So that's also a little sobering, a little humiliating in a way, a little humbling. In fact, I would say humbling, not for Indra, not humbling. Humbling is a better word. He starts this huge, what Swamiji will call this huge ego, starts, you know, lightening up a little bit. And as it lightens up, he sits there and just waits. And then what happens is a beautiful feminine deity, a woman, who is shining with light, just shining in light, luminescent, beautiful female figure who happens to be Uma. Uma is the daughter of the Himalayas, the god of the Himavat. Haimavat, she's called Haimavat, the daughter of the Himalayas. And so she now's Uma is there. Uma is considered the manifestation of knowledge. So Uma is there. And he just humbly put, you know, doing this with his hands, humbly bowing down. And he asks her, who is that? Because, you know, Uma, he recognizes. And so very humbly he says, who is that yaksha that has appeared before us? You've never seen that yaksha before. Who is that yaksha? And she says to him, that yaksha who you saw, that is Brahman. That is Brahma. And then all of a sudden, he understood. He understood. She said a little more. She said, that is Brahman. Brahman who was victorious, Brahman who was victorious over the war, in the war between the Devas and the Asuras, it was that Brahman who was victorious over the Asuras, which all of you were praised for. It was that Brahman, you know. And then all of a sudden he kind of understood, you know, kind of pulled back. And then understanding that, he even bowed to her, and then he went back. He went back to the Devas, and he taught. So first he goes back and he teaches both Agni and Vayu that was Brahman. And having taught them, then they can go and teach the other Devas. So that's the story. But there's actually quite a bit in that story. The form of the yaksha had to disappear, right? Form had to disappear. One thing Swamiji says about this yaksha, by the way, and then the appearance of yaksha, that this appearance of the, and the Shastra says also, as we go through the verses, we'll see, the appearance of the yaksha was Brahman taking that form for a specific purpose, and the purpose of that yaksha was to give self-knowledge to the Devas who were seeking to know. They were seeking to know now in the form of the yaksha, but he appeared as that yaksha for a particular purpose, kind of to entice them and also to deflate their egos a little bit and give them that desire to know so that they would be ready to actually understand who that really was. And so Brahman appeared as an avatar in the form of this yaksha. Because what we say for the avatars, whether it be Krishna or Rama, there's some 18 avatars that have taken birth here in this loka, according to the tradition. They take birth in order to take care of a specific purpose. They have a specific purpose. The purpose of Rama was to destroy Ravana, the head of the Rakshasas, who was actually destroying all of the Dharma and destroying the creation. So he took birth in order to destroy Ravana. Krishna took birth in order to help Arjuna win this war between Dharma and Adharma. Because Adharma, under Duryodhana, was rampant and everyone was coming under their sway. And so it was Arjuna who had to be, as the kind of the king of the Pandavas and the king of the Dharmanishtas, really had to win that war, but he needed Krishna's help. And so Krishna took that birth really to bring back the balance of Dharma and Adharma. What we say actually is that the main cause of Ishwara taking a form, that Ishwara isn't born, there's no prior karma. It's Ishwara takes this form. In fact, for Ishwara, we say the form is Pratibhasika. Bhagawan is this infinite conscious being, takes a form which is invoked by the need of all of the jivas. And the need of all of the need is a particular need, that there is a balance, there is an imbalance between dharma and adharma, to the point that the dharmis can't manage anymore. They can't survive anymore. And so when that becomes the case, you know, then Bhagavan will take a form in order to balance that, so that the dharma and the dharma is always held by the dharmis. Adharma is held by the adharmis. It's not like dharma is walking around there. Dharma is something that is held by the jivas. And so when the adharma becomes so bad or so dense that the dharmis can no longer perform their dharma or survive, really, you know, at that time, the universe, the Ishwara, is invoked in the form of an avatar. And so here, in this case, Swamiji is using to these yakshas, which is, we're on a different loka now, we're in the Deva loka. Right? But it was important, for whatever reason, that that the devas, you know, were able to themselves gain knowledge, you know, in order probably to keep a balance, because their egos were getting very puffy. So that, a couple of interesting points here we'll get into maybe more later in the next class. A couple of interesting points, you know, is that the devas themselves, they're looked at exalted jivas. They're exalted jivas who, because of tremendous punya, take a more subtle incarnation as a jiva on a higher loka, so very subtle, and their powers are much greater. So those devas need, just like on this plane, they need to become mumukshus, they need to want to know, they need to gain knowledge through the shastra, because they have the same problem, even though they've got a subtle body, more subtle body, and more powers, all of their powers are in reference to handling this world and existing within this world. Their sense organs are all going out. The mind itself, you know, gains vrittis, just like this mind gains vritti from the from their sense perceptions and whatever powers and capacities they have in the mind. They don't have self-knowledge. Their upadhi, the nature of that upadhi may reflect the ananda swarupa more than, you know, a mortal's, one of our, you know, manusha's upadhi, because of the raw type of raw, because of the type of subtlety that form enjoys. But they are still a jiva. They're just an exalted jiva because of punya. They don't necessarily have knowledge. And so here, as this story goes, because of great punya, actually, even on their part, this group of devas were able to win this battle against the asuras, and it was a very important battle. They had to win it, really. But in the end, who really won the battle? You know, who is the self of all of those jivas in terms of Ishwara? Who has the capacity? Is the capacity yours, or is it the capacity Ishwara's? Is your strength, or does the strength belong to Ishwara? Are these your sense organs, or are they Ishwara's sense organs? Are all of your skills and capacities, are they your skills and capacities, or are they Ishwara's skills and capacities? Is the karma pala that you're receiving, is that because of you, or does that karma pala, the fruit of your actions, come from Ishwara? And so the devas were too full of themselves in this story, and they were reveling in their success, you know, without giving any credit to Ishwara. No credit to Ishwara, you know. And so in chapter three, I was talking to somebody about this the other day, one of you, chapter 3 and chapter 4, but especially chapter 3 in the and chapter 4 in both, there's so many verses talking about Ishvara, all of the vibhutis of Ishvara in reference to this creation. And then it goes on about how it really, as jivas, it is our duty really to give thanks. Like when we say Brahmarpanam, you know, and we say our prayers before eating, it says you should always acknowledge the one from whom all of this food has come. You should always acknowledge with gratitude all of the gifts that come your way. To life itself, having this body itself, having food and having air and having the whole circumstance that we find ourselves in that allows us to live and to prosper. So all of, it's not right, it just says flatly, it is not right, you're acting like a thief. It's acting like a thief if you don't give thanks and acknowledge who you're getting all these gifts for, you become a steha, it's called, you know, a thief. And so, make sure that you do all of your pujas and say all of your thanks. That's your dharma as a human being. And so here, with this tremendous victory, because so that's kind of very well known within the tradition, but the devas, in their exuberance of this extraordinary win over the asuras, they didn't give thanks to Bhagavan. They didn't see all of their capacities and all of their, you know, viryam, all of their strength. Virya means strength and capacity. And they didn't recognize that all is only Bhagavan. So they didn't acknowledge Bhagavan. They just took all the credit for themselves, you know. They should have said something like, what would they say really? They should have said when they were being worshipped and, you know, given pujas and held in this high esteem with all kinds of honors and flowers and all, they were as though being given the pujas. What would they, maybe they could have said, this is all really Ishvara. This is Bhagavan's grace. Because that's the truth, you know? So when you don't say that, when you don't recognize that, then there's a big ego there. We could call it a big ego. It's not a big or small ego, really. It's just for someone like the devatas, you would think that they would give credit where credit is due, you know? And so they didn't. They didn't. They were just totally self-absorbed. And so Swamiji will say it, you know, that ego has become very heavy. It's very heavy and it has to be lightened up a little bit. You have to lighten it up so that they become, you know, available to remember and to know. And so that's why he decides, you know, let me, knowing what they need at this time in order to kind of lighten up, all, you know, this ego, let me just appear as a yaksha, who they don't recognize. So he appeared as this very beautiful, compelling, that's what part of the word, my yaksha itself means that which is puja, that which is worshipful. When you see it, your mind is enthralled and you want to please it, you want to be with it, you want to show off to it, you want to be loved by it. That's the kind of the bhava of the yaksha. So when this yaksha appeared, none of them recognized, who is that? Who is that? What kind of a celestial being is that? They had no idea. They would have looked at each other, okay, Agni, you go. You go and find out who it is. Yes, I'll go. He goes and has very unsuccessful time, you know. And he comes back. I don't know who it is. Vayu, you please go. He goes. Unsuccessful time. Comes back. A little bit deflated. Because I am the Lord of wind. I can lift up the whole universe, anything. I can blow anything away. How could this be impossible? And so then Indra has to go. Indra is the lord of all of the senses. He's the king of all the devas. And so that's the king of all the, really sattva, of all that that enjoys jyotish, you know, the light. So he's the mind. He stands for the mind. And so now the mind goes and then sees as he's approaching, sees that yaksha disappear. Okay? So there's these wonderful verses like Navacho Namanasa. It says the speech, which is Agni, you know, approaches Brahman and comes back unfulfilled. Even the mind, it approaches Brahman, comes back unfulfilled. Even the mind cannot reach it, nor can the sense organs, nor can the speech. None of these can reach Brahman. Why? Because Brahman's not an object of knowledge to be reached. Brahman is yourself. And so now, Indra, who's the king of all of the sense organs, the mind itself, goes in order to know this yaksha. But this yaksha, knowing kind of how to handle these guys, these devas, as Indra, you know, the final one, comes and approaches, that yaksha totally disappears. And Indra doesn't run away. He doesn't run back to the others and say, I don't know who that yaksha is. You know, he is not so happy to run back and say, I approached the yaksha, and as I was approaching, it just went away. So I didn't even get to see it. Yeah. But he didn't run back. He didn't do anything. He just stayed there and waited. Yeah. And as he stayed there and waited with Shraddha for something to happen, then Uma appeared. And Uma is really the Brahmavidya. Uma stands for Brahmavidya. And so that means that Brahmavidya, that teaching was necessary in order to, even though this is put in a very abbreviated form, if you understand it as Brahmavidya, it took Uma, who stands for the Brahmavidya, to reveal to Indra that yaksha was really only Brahman, is only Brahman. Now, to say that, well, yeah, but it was a yaksha, it wasn't Brahman. No, it was Brahman, just like you were Brahman, just like you were Brahman, just like you were Brahman. That yaksha is also Brahman. You know? And so then he understood. He understood that Brahman, the yaksha is Brahman. Brahman has no form. And so you have to, the story is very, very terse, but Uma made Indra recognize, really, basically, that yaksha is Brahman and that Brahman is myself. That Uma as the shastra, as the teaching, that was given to Indra. And then Indra now, having received this teaching and recognizing I am Brahman, Indra becomes, among the devas that were there, the first guru. Because this knowledge has been now given to Indra, and now Indra knows I am Brahman. And so, knowing that I am Brahman, he goes back and tells Agni and Vayu, who also had kind of a difficult experience and were humbled, he told these two, he taught them, you are Brahman. The same way that Uma taught him, he taught Agni and Vayu. And so then these two became worshipful. Indra was the most worshipful because he was the first one to gain this knowledge. He was the first guru among this group. And so he's even the guru now of Vayu and Agni. And so Vayu and Agni have respect, guru-sisha respect for Indra. And then all of the other people, devas, they taught, and then they have second respect. Right. So they're in the line of respect. Right. There's Uma, who gave the Brahmavidya, and she's like Dakshinamurti, so she gave the Brahmavidya. Indra received that. He becomes the first guru of this group, and so he is respected and honored by all, because the guru, the one who passes this on, is the most worshipful. Okay. So Indra is the most worshipful. He gives it to Agni and Vayu. Agni and Vayu give it to the rest. And so they become also worshipful by the group. Why? Because they have Brahmavidya. They know who they are. And so in this Guru Sisha Parampara, you know, so just think of this, if you kind of translate this, in the Guru Sisha Parampara, that means in the whole tradition of teaching with the teacher, student, teacher, student, teacher, student, from beginningless time, there is, if you follow this chain, Guru Sisha, Guru Sisha, Guru Sisha, if you follow this chain back up, there is actually an infinite gratitude that goes all the way back up to the first teacher and then to Ishwara himself. It'll go all the way back up. And so say, I feel so much, for Swamiji, I feel so much, How can you even say it? It's like an infinite gratitude that's unexpressible, because what this knowledge means to us is something you can't even say. The gratitude is so much. But then Swamiji, he feels that for his guru. In fact, I'll never forget, and it's still so vivid in my mind. We were in some small little town. This was in the 70s, early 70s, before the first course was started. So it's about 1972. And we were on the Yagna Trail with Swamiji. And so he would go from town to town. For a while, we were all riding in trains, and he would be in the first class, and we'd all be jammed up in the third class behind him. You know, and sometimes we'd even be on a different train and get there. But anyway, we followed him around, a big group of us, mostly Indians. We followed him all over the country, really, as he went on these yagnas. So we went to this little town, and the yagnas were usually outside, like in a park, and there would be these big tents that we would sit under the tent so that we'd have shade, and they would build a platform for him, and he would be sitting at the platform teaching the Upanishad or whatever it was. And so I forget now the Upanishad. Maybe it was even the Kena Upanishad, because it would be appropriate because of the story I'm telling you now, but I don't remember what it was. But he started talking about the Guru-Sisha relationship and how the knowledge is passed and the Sampradaya. That was the subject matter. And all of a sudden, he became totally overwhelmed. And it's like he closed his eyes, and it was almost like he was so full of emotion and gratitude and tears without tears coming, that we all sat there as he was kind of being with himself for maybe 10 minutes or more. He was so overwhelmed with that, the love, really, that Sampradaya, you know, he couldn't contain it. And I totally understand that, because if I think of him, I feel that way, you know. How can we ever, what can we say? This Sampradaya, this knowledge, I can't even imagine not having it. And you can't imagine not having it. We can't go backwards. We can mature and all of this, but the more clarity you have, you can't remember. It's like if you've once mistaken a rope for a snake, once you see the rope, you can't get that snake back. You can remember and you can teach all about it, but you actually can't get it back, because you removed the cause. If you remove the cause, you can't get it back, so you can't have that experience again. Even though you can teach the whole thing, because you can remember, I'm not saying you don't remember, you just can't get the experience back again, you know. And so that is a given. That's how it is. But the wonderful thing about that, the beauty of that is that, to say it in kind of a silly way, you're more or less finished. It's over, you know. You can't get the ignorance back. And so who you are, what you've recognized, just keeps maturing inside of yourself, the different connections that you need to make, the different pieces of clarity and all of that that come. They come in their own time. Your antakarna shuddhi blossoms like a flower. Swamiji will use always the example of, you know, the little rosebud. That we just, all we have to do with that beautiful little rosebud is, you know, water it and keep it in the sun. It has the right fertilizer, the right environment. Keep a little fence around it if necessary. Give it the protection and what it needs in order to grow, you know. And it will just take care of itself. So our task is really to let that happen, you know, to protect it, to keep in the company of the good. By that means keep in the company of people that you respect, that you have the same values, or the same values that will kind of be the water that water you. Keep in the satsang, keep in a sangha as much as you can, you know. Just until you are a walking sangha yourself, you know. Until that time, keep that little rose protected. Keep yourself occupied in shravana, manana, nididhyasana to some extent, so that you're not always just being overwhelmed by samsara, you know. Let yourself be overwhelmed by knowledge also, so that you gain that strength. That's all just tending the garden, so to speak, in a reasonable way, you know. Like you say, a little beautiful little rose, you don't go ahead and plant a bunch of weeds in there, you know, unless the weeds are conducive to its growth. That's fine. So you just protect that knowledge, and the knowledge takes care of itself, you know. And you will do that, because what else are you going to do? You know, the problem, one of the problems that we have is thinking we need to do more than we need to do. You know, that I don't know what that's about. It's just being a Westerner, probably. We want to do more than is actually necessary to do. That's why in the last verse of this last chapter, this idea that viryam, that capacity, you gain by yourself, through your mind, by your own values. It's not about who you, where you are. It's about how you are there with all of that. And that itself naturally brings about the antakarna shuddhi in time. We say that this is one way I think is really helpful to understand it. As you gain knowledge, your buddhi is different, because you have a knowledge, a self-knowledge that you didn't have before. What that means is that all of the thoughts, all of the emotions, all of the reactions, which are in the manas, right, are now coming up into a buddhi which is different. It's a different buddhi in terms of your understanding, in terms of your knowledge. So that all of these past ways of being, past ways of reacting, things that you may not have a value for now, they still rise up. They'll still rise up, but they're rising up into somebody who has a different way of relating to them than before. And that is the one that has knowledge and also knows how to handle all the little ones inside, knows how to handle these complexes in the light of your knowledge. Then, as it rises in, these things are transformed by that. So they'll come a few times, but they're coming to you, the one who has knowledge, these times. And so they drop off, because there's no one that relates to them in the way that you used to relate to them without some value. If what rises up is something that is valuable, then that stays. But if something rises up that goes against who you are now, then that gains, you know, the care that it needs in order to transform. It doesn't get stomped on. It doesn't get pushed away. It doesn't rise up into anger. It rises up like into a good parent, you know. You can give all of those vrittis now the support that they need to go through the changes that will be very natural to them. But you can't kind of dictate which vrittis are going to rise up or which things are going to be triggered. Bhagavan takes care of that. It's all in your unconscious. What's going to rise up? You can't say, okay, I want this to rise up now. You don't even know half the things that are there. You know, they start rising up, then they rise up, and then they're there for you to be with. And they rise up for you to be with when your ego means in a Jungian sense, when your conscious mind is there, able to deal with them. You know, and so there's kind of a layering effect. Things that are easiest first rise up first. Things that are a little harder, then they rise up. But as these things rise up, each time that you're with them, you become stronger. So then you can handle the next layer. But you don't notice it because you're stronger than you were with the first layer. And so your buddhi becomes stronger and stronger and stronger and is able to handle kind of the deeper things or the more hurtful things that are being held down. And so you have to really trust in that process, that the things that you need to work with come up as you're ready for them. It's perfect, actually. And for that, this process of relieving ourselves from pain and painful attitudes, that process takes place in time, and you have to, and in Ishwara's time, not in Jiva Srishti, in Ishwara Srishti. Who is that?
A wheelbarrow?
A wheelbarrow?
Yeah.
Wow.
I thought it was a bird.
I thought it was a bird.
Interesting, okay. I thought it was a little squeaking bird. What kind of bird is that? So anyway. So I guess one of the things that's been so very important and helpful for me is, and from, of course, getting all of this from Swamiji in so many different ways, is that patience, not thinking that your mind or your expression is, you gain some knowledge and now you become this perfect jnani that's walking around, you know, blazing with light and love and goodness, and that there's nothing to be worked on. You know, you gain this knowledge and your understandings of inner child work and how to be with the complexes and how to be with other people and how to do these contemplations that help us to resolve in a more timely way some of the different types of reactions and hurts that we suffer from. We learn all of these things and they become natural practices for yourself, and that really helps the mind to grow and mature and shed off, you know, the old things that have caused ourselves pain and others' pain also. But that requires, you know, trust and patience. You know, I think that's a great thing, learning how to be patient. And when you learn how to be patient with yourself and your own maturing process as that goes, which it will go, you can't stop it. If you just, even now with the amount of time you've been studying, if you look back, looking backwards is always good. You can see so much change and so much growth and so much, and that just keeps going. The flower keeps unfolding, you know. And also, even for Swamiji, in some ways, the flower with somebody that has unimaginable, in my mind, antakarana shuddhi, the flower kept unfolding because of how to handle some more difficult situations, how to be, it's a learning process. The learning process of how to really handle in a proper way the situations that come my way, you know. So you're continually learning. It's not like you become this open flower and now all learning is done. Within creation, all learning of understanding Ishvara, understanding the complexities of life, understanding other people, you know, that goes on, that learning goes on and on and on. Even Swamiji's from the time in the 70s to say in the 80s, from the 70s and probably before, his teaching methodology even changed so much. Because I think I've mentioned before, for him, when he first started teaching, in his mind, this knowledge, this pramana, once the student was exposed to it and understood, there were no more problems. That's it. And he had kind of a disdain. I can't say Swamiji has disdain, but he had very, very little respect for anything to do with psychology. He didn't know anything about it, and he felt like this knowledge was all that was needed. And he would talk like that in class with a lot of strength, you know. And I said, until he met us. Until he met Westerners, you know. Serious people who really understood this knowledge, and they still had issues. He didn't have any understanding of complexes or traumas or transference. No understanding at all. Never heard of it. That's right. It's not that he didn't get it. He'd never heard of it, you know. And so then when we started talking to him about these things, then he took all that very seriously, and he learned about all of it, and he learned about all these different types of meditation, and he learned a lot about Jung also, and he started incorporating all of that into his teaching, into his meditations, understanding transference, understanding how to deal with that. Otherwise, not having a clue. I mean, why is this student, whom I love so much, treating me like this? Because there's a negative father transference, you know, or negative mother transference, and so then they're so angry and hurt and projecting all of these bad intentions onto Swamiji, and he would kind of be stunned, like, what is this? But then, so he wanted to know. He's curious. He has that curious mind. He wanted to know, and he learned. And he also learned how to be with that in a way that is really helpful, you know. And then he did that. He never ever stopped learning. And he never stopped expanding his, you could say expanding his compassion. Compassion, by that I mean his main drishti in all my years with him is, how can I help? Not even his words, it's just, how can I help with this situation, you know? What would make this better? And then realizing that all the things that he thought would really help were not working, and why, how could that be possible? So he wanted to know, because he couldn't understand, how could this, they gain this knowledge and still, you know, have all of these issues? He didn't know even about the unconscious, you know? Now, before, you know, the latter years of his life, he could have such conversation with any psychologist and teach them things also. So many would say that. I also recognized it myself as a psychologist, but people who would come, you know, who are psychologists and meet Swamiji for the first time and have these conversations, Swamiji would talk to them and say what he had discovered and all of this, and they would really, you know, really be pleased. So I'm just saying all of this because of allowing all of us to be deeply rewarded by our patients. Deeply rewarded. Because if you give yourself patience, if you're patient to the same degree that you would be patient to your little child. Imagine a little child struggling to walk. It's such a big deal, you know. Being able to get up. Even to get up and stand without and let go. This is amazing, amazing thing, you know. And the parents, normal parents, I think, real parents, would just be so happy to see this child standing, even if it's for two seconds. It's the first standing, you know. So happy, you know. Because there's something going on there. And then that first step, oh my goodness, you know. And then it's a little falling on its butt. And all of these, every part, there is so much love, you know. But we have to have kind of, maybe we're not as excited as that, you know. But the way that we hold our own maturing and our own letting things drop off and our own ability to not act out and all of these things, you notice that. You should be very pleased, very, very pleased. And even when you fall on your butt, you know, and you're not doing as well as you did the last time or whatever, that doesn't make any difference at all. It's like if you're a pianist and you're doing the scales, I don't know if you've ever had to learn piano like I did when I was a little girl, you do the scales, and you learn to be very comfortable with the scales, and then you make a mistake. And then you don't go, oh no, you know. I thought I could do this, now I can't do it. You don't think like that. You just start again and do the scales, you know? So that we have to have that kind of love for the process. Because that also, that's a love for yourself. It's a love for your buddhi. It's a love for your own maturing process. It's something very, very beautiful. And patience gives you that love. Without the patience, there's tension, yeah, and worry and all of that. So if you have the patience, the flower just is allowed to open it, you appreciate every step of the way. It's not that you don't know. As you become more kind, you know you're more kind, you know. If your mind is reacting less, you know it's reacting less. So you can say that, very good. It's very good, you know. Because it is very good, you know. And falling on your butt doesn't make you bad. It means you're trying. That's what we're all doing. We're trying. We're getting this knowledge and letting the flower unfold. Oh, that's
Shanti Hari Om Shri Guru Pya.
Hrishyo Namaha Harihi Om.
So next class we're going to go over the Sanskrit, and then there's a few more things in the story that I want to talk about, but we will do the Sanskrit. All of your Sanskrit training. It's nice to see the Sanskrit anyway. Mm-hmm.